And welcome back, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Robert. And Amy, it's very, very nice to be back.
Oh, I'm glad that you're back and everything went well.
Yes, it did. It was, I thought a lot about that previous interview, that very first interview before I went. And Robert, you said, you know, that you thought that the idea of me being out there without cell coverage or being stranded and how awful that would be, that was, well, it was on my mind. There were some days that were like that. There was no cell coverage. I was out there for hours. There was no traffic and things like that. And then Robbie said, you know, the idea that you get an injury. And, you know, there I did. I did it 750 miles, and I had a lot of heat blisters, but I never got anything worse than that. You know, like, I don't know, hairline fracture in the ankle, or I had a lot of bruises. Oh, man, I have an injury now. I have my two last fingers in my right hand are numb, and they have been for about, they started getting numb about 2 weeks before the end of the March. And the simple guess is that from the sheer shock of carrying the pack, you know, 24 miles a day.
Right.
All those hours. So Monty is giving me a massage, you know, acupressure in the morning and in the evening. And we're hoping that that will sort of work it out. I mean, if not, obviously I have to do something else.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious what the problem must be.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like maybe a little bit of nerve damage, certainly from that pack.
Yeah, or a pinched nerve, something like that.
Right.
You know, that it's also, oddly enough, it's on the same in my right foot. I have the toes, the middle toes of my right foot are also numb.
Huh, interesting.
But, yeah, isn't it? And when she does the acupressure, my back is one plate. There's no pliability in the muscle structure. It's all just very, very hard, and
right.
My shoulders are both also very hard, so we're slowly working it down. I've been back for 2 weeks now, and
right.
It's amazing how long this takes to work out, but I have high hopes that it will be fine. I mean, I'm still, you know, at the end, I was doing 24 miles a day, 25 miles a day, I mean, and, you know, I came back on a Thursday, so we took Friday off. By Saturday morning, I was getting pretty restless, wanting to go out and do something.
I can imagine.
It's amazing what you can get used to. And so, more on this later, I started campaigning for local city council candidates here in Seattle as part of my peace activist work. And I was out there. It was the weekend before the primary, so that's a crucial weekend. So I was out there for several hours on Saturday, on Sunday, on Monday, and I'm still doing it now. I mean, it's obviously eased off because they're after the primary. But, you know, like this morning, Monty and I went for a 3-mile hike this morning, first thing. And then later in the day, I did some work here at home. And then I went out for another 3-mile hike by myself. It was more and more, a 4 or 5-mile hike by myself, you know, in the afternoon.
Yeah.
It's amazing how this thing can become such a habit.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it.
Yeah, I mean, walking every day for 40 days, you're going to get pretty much in a habit of doing that.
I wish we'd get in a habit.
Well, you know, remember how I did it? I just, like, you know, I started with 3 and then 4, and then it just sort of grows from there if you want.
Right.
Yeah.
You got to get me out of the house first.
I mean, you know what I like about hiking is I've met so many runners, because I used to run myself, and they have all this hip damage and knee damage and ankle damage, and I don't know any hikers who have that kind of damage.
Right.
And if you ask me, it's in the DNA, because as a humanist, I understand the story of humanity. I'm fascinated by it. And the 3 million years of the Stone Age, those people were doing exactly what I was doing, just walking for 25 miles a day, you know, as they gathered their food and, you know, moved from place to place.
Yeah,
that's just what we are bred to do.
That's very true. I actually had thought about that because, you know, that is in our DNA. It makes complete sense.
Yeah, we're actually...
Doesn't it?
Yeah, we evolved as a long-distance species.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually really cool that you can keep up with that. So I wanted to know, what was, like, your favorite moment of the entire trip?
I think it was the night... it's hard for me to choose. I can think of 2 or 3. I'm just going to start talking.
Okay.
And if I go too long, you stop me, okay?
Not a problem.
there was a night at the historic 9-Miler Ranger Station, which is part of the New Deal, which always warms my heart because I love American history and how FDR turned this country around during the Great Depression. And I was part of that, the Civilian Conservation Corps. These people who are out of work in places like Chicago got railroaded out to, you know, Montana. And they built all these trails, and they used mules to do it. And so they built this sort of monument, this ranger station, to mules and how hardy an animal they can be. And the park ranger, who's really kind of hot, she agreed. She's talking on the phone with Manu. Manu suddenly told her that I could stay in some place around that. They were very cautious about it because they don't want to get into something like that. But the idea was that I was going to go like another mile down the road, and she knew a farmer, I could stay in his field. And it was a very hard day's hike for me. It was I was at Mullins Pass. I was coming down. It was really, really tough. Sorry, not Mullins Pass, Siegel's Pass. I did two passes. This is the second one. And I was I couldn't seem to get there. The map was wrong. Google Maps was wrong that we were using, the logistics team was using. And it was farther, much farther than... And that happened to us a lot. You know, when you get to the when you're in urban areas, Google Maps is excellent. It's just right down to the, you know, a couple yards in accuracy. But when you get out to the rural areas, and they say themselves, it's a beta product. It's I found a lot of mistakes out there, and this is one of those mistakes. It just seemed long. All the march math was wrong. I was really, really exhausted, and I just could not find this place, even though I was on the trail. And when I finally got there, and I was. Part of what's upsetting me was, you know, it's I had to get there by 5 before it closed because it is a visitor center. And I was worried about if I don't get there and she's gone, because you think, well, maybe he's somewhere else. What do I do? Do I just, like, keep walking and pitch my tent and whatever is available? Well, I did get there in time, and I looked at her and she looked at me, and I guess she liked what she saw because she took pity on me, even though as tired as I was. And she allowed me to pitch my tent in a back corral. And, you know, they have a lot of horses, a lot of mules as part of the ranger station. And typically what I do, because that was a long day for me. It was like 28 miles that day. It was, struggling. Well, just seemed to struggle to nail it down. For me, I was tired. I didn't care. I pitched my tent, and there's no trees in a corral, right? So there was an abandoned trailer, so I pitched my tent right up against that. Shade becomes very crucial in such situations. I learned that.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Exactly. That's where I got my shade from. So, and I crawled inside a tent and stripped down, and I just lay down in my sleeping bag, and I mainly just passed out.
Yeah.
And she said later, I met her the next morning. She said she came by later to talk to me, but I was out probably snoring or something. But somewhere around 9 o'clock, I woke up and went outside, maybe it's around 10, and the sun was going down. And this is around Missoula, and I knew from experience, that having passed through Missoula, Montana, and then Missoula once before, how beautiful Missoula and that those environments can be. And it was quite picturesque there. I was at the bottom of a valley in this corral, which I love because the smell of horse flesh is all around me, including the poop, which I don't really understand why I find that romantic, but I do. And the hills of the valley were rising up around me. There were no trees on the valley floor, but around us, on the walls of the valley, there were. And the horses had gone in, the mules had gone in, but I could still see how beautiful it was. And then the sky above me was really gorgeous. And I thought, sitting there, very, very tired, my feet are killing me, and I'm glad not to have any injuries. I'm glad the day is over. And I realized this could quite possibly be the most beautiful night of the entire march. And I just sat there drinking it in and wondering, does this mean that someday Monty and I will move here? You know, when we retire, we'll just, wherever we go, whatever we do with our lives, that maybe we will move to someplace out in Missoula, maybe even the, you know, the 9 Mile Road, you know, the somewhere nearby this ranger station. It's a thought.
Yeah.
And then the next morning when I got up at 5 like I usually do, well, that was Montana, so it was 6 because the lighting was different. There's not enough light at 5.
Right.
And I was hiking in. I was on like a few miles down the road when Lauren, the park ranger, came in, and she was towing a trailer behind her, and she came in early to talk to me. And so we had this nice conversation there on the road. There I was hiking down the road, and she was just sorry that that I was asleep last night, that she didn't get a chance to talk to me. So we talked a little bit about where I was going, and she gave lots of advice. And I really liked that. There was what Lauren's reaction was. I got a lot of that. People were really first incredulous, like, "What are you doing?" And then second, the sort of admiration. So this is a world peace kind of thing you're doing this. And then third, after they had processed all that, there was this concern, this worry about, are you going to be okay? I mean, it could have been the girl working in the convenience store, Rock Island, Washington, who said, tell me you're drinking water. I want to know you're drinking water. How much water are you drinking today? Right, that kind of thing. Or is Monica, this German immigrant of 30, 40 years, who owns this RV campground place in Sprague Lake, Eastern Washington, who, once she realized what I was doing, she started making me dinner, and then she gave me some beer, a few cans of this, you know, very Germanic 3% beer. And then the last time I saw her, it was like, I don't know, midnight or something like that. I was asleep, and then I heard someone walking by my tent, and I woke up, and it was Monica. She was reading something on the picnic table, and when I got up at 5, I realized she had left me some moleskin or molefoam, you know, for my feet, because she was worried that my feet would be, you know, I mean, would be hurt, you know, from this long 750-mile hike, you know, for peace.
That's really nice. It sounds like you met a lot of nice people.
I did. And, you know, by the end, the big shock, you know, we started this with the idea was I was going to march to Old Faithful. I was going to dare God to strike things lightning. And we realized pretty quickly into the march that people were really, really upset by that. It just was, it sounded alienating, really upsetting. So we just dropped it.
Right.
Jumped overboard, bad cargo. And I thought of lightning and says, I hope that this can be something that lights people up in the heart, you know, zaps them like a bolt of lightning or something like that.
Right.
But it changed further as I kept going, and I kept talking about this world that I dreamed about, this world without war. And people near the end, I realized they were starting to look at me as when the numbers got higher, you know, past, it was past 600 miles, I think that's when it happened. I realized that people were starting to look at me as some sort of peace activist.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Who does this? Who marches, hikes 750 miles, no support, there's no following car. There's completely on my own. I'm out there for 40 days. I had some bad moments, particularly in Eastern Washington, because the temperatures broke over 110 degrees. Huh. Particularly one bad day where I came very, very close to a heat stroke. And who does that? I can't do that. I wouldn't do that. And I met a lot of really alpha males. We called it the challenge. It sort of became a joke that whenever I'd meet a certain alpha male type and he would find out what I was doing, he would get really upset, and that it challenged his maleness, his manhood.
Huh.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And so they would try to dominate me in another way. They would say, well, what you should do is you should be going down this road, and then you should take a left here, and, you know, that kind of thing. Or do you have bear spray, and, you know, that kind of thing. Because, you know, bear spray is sprays, you know, 30 feet away. I mean, you know that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I learned over time just sort of, like, sidestep it.
Right.
But, and that was the shadow side of what I experienced. The positive side was people were just really impressed. I had a secret fear that people would mock me, would make fun of me, but nobody did. Nobody did. Everybody was just, you really want this. You want this world without war. I can't dream that big like you do, but, you know, Jeff, you keep on dreaming. You just keep on dreaming, all right? And stay safe, all right? There was always that same refrain. You stay safe. And it made me feel really, really well taken care of.
Yeah.
Even if, you know, I did the numbers once, because when you're hiking that long by yourself, you have a lot of time to think about stuff.
Yeah.
And so I worked out the numbers once, and I realized that 96% of the time I was spending by myself in solitude.
Right. But when you were there in that solitude, I mean, did you really feel alone then? I mean, was that part of the feeling?
Sometimes I did, but mostly you're correct. You're right. I did not. I refused to allow myself to, because it was day after day after day of that. No, that's not true either, because that was the early days. Later it became such a habit that I didn't even think about it. I just was doing what I do.
Yeah.
In fact, the last night, sorry?
No, I was just agreeing with you. I could see that.
Mm-hmm. And then the last night, my final night of the march, I was there. I was back to... it was some of the worst ground I've ever been over, and this is in training or on the hike itself. And then I got to this really beautiful Lake Mallard, which is just an hour's simple march from Old Faithful itself. I took the back way in, and I was sitting there. It was a really, really back country. Nobody goes there. I mean, it may be an hour from Old Faithful, but nobody's going to go there. And I was by myself, and there were three campsites, and I pitched my tent and everything, and it wasn't very much in sight at all. And I was sitting there just thinking about how meditating on the fact that this is my last night. It's been 40 days. Tomorrow I'm going to go to Old Faithful. It's over. I made it. I didn't get a broken leg. I didn't get a sprained ankle or something. I mean, I'm going to see mommy again. And then I heard this voice, and I thought, that's human. That's not a bird. That's not a deer or something. That's impossible. I'm out in the boonies. It's not going to happen. But I went quiet, and then sure enough, I heard an answering voice. And so I waited, and then it was three girls. And so I crawled out, and I had a cut on my leg from something. So I went down to the lake and washed it. And as I was standing there, I saw them, and so I called, hello. And it turned out to be three ethnic Chinese girls from Asia. Two were students at the UCLA, LA, and they were they had graduated. They're doing their labs for law, and they're going to go back to Asia and take up their lives there. One of whom was from Taiwan, and I used to live in Taiwan for a number of years. So Pearl and I immediately bonded, and this was all at a distance. They're shouting to each other, I guess we're neighbors for the night. And, you know, I had learned on this trail that when people are camping, they don't really want neighbors to come over and talk to them. They'll talk for a few minutes, but not very long. And so I learned to respect that. And so that night I went over to say hello to them, and fully expecting that it would be a short conversation, but it turned out to be like this 3 or 4 hour long conversation about, you know, who they are as Chinese girls who lived in America going back to Asia, their ambivalence about that, the fact that I knew about that, the fact that I'm a feminist who instinctively turns to women of color and tries to give them a leg up because I know that they have so much stacked against them. They sort of just warmed to that. And, you know, they fed me dinner and they were totally into what I was doing too. Yeah. And finally they said, we made a fire together and it got very, very cold. It was like 29 degrees or something like that.
Wow.
And you know, none of us have any special equipment for that kind of thing. I mean, I had a space blanket that I wrapped around. I had learned to wrap around my second leg so I could sleep comfortably. But nobody's carrying long underwear or anything.
Right.
There was such a fire danger that all the fire, I was looking forward to campfires every single night on this march. That was what I was telling myself I was looking forward to as a Boy Scout. But because fire danger was so high, I couldn't have them. So I threw out all my fire building equipment. So there I am this last night, and I'm finally in a place where you can have a fire safely. And I don't have any fire building equipment. They don't have any fire building equipment. But we decided we were going to do this. So the four of us together sort of did this project, and we built a fire, a campfire. And it was really quite sweet.
That's really awesome.
That really is. Mm.
So, yeah, much, much different from spending, you know, 23 hours out of the day by myself, you know, with no conversation whatsoever.
All right.
So that next morning, you obviously made it to Old Faithful. How did it feel when you first saw Old Faithful? I mean, you'd been walking for 40 days. How was that?
Surprisingly, it was anticlimactic. It was underwhelming.
Oh, no kidding.
Short. Yes, it is. It's a very short geyser. I didn't realize that. There are taller geysers in Yellowstone. And I did this. What was the best part about it was the human interaction, because after this hellacious hike, and it was hellacious, so many times I said, don't get silly now. This is where mistakes happen. I can't count the number of times I said that to myself that last day, because it's up and down and all the switchbacks back and forth and a lot of really treacherous ground, easy to turn an ankle. You're so close. Do not fuck up now. Please do not do this now. And then the next morning was this really easy level hike, which is why, you know, what the girls did. I mean, they, you know, Pearl and Kathleen and Jean, they parked their van at, which is one of the themes of the hike. There were no hikers. 40 days, 750 miles. I didn't see another hiker.
Wow.
I think it's going out of fashion. Everybody who is, you know, packing in a tank is everybody RVs. And if you're not RVing, then if they're in a tent and doing that out of the back of a car or out of a motorcycle, or rare cases they do it off the bicycle. Nobody packs walks like I was.
Yeah, that's definitely not.
And so, you know, these girls, you know, it's their last hurrah, so they decided they wanted to see the major parks of the United States before they went back. So they drove in a van to Old Faithful, and then took that nice easy 1 hour hike over level ground to our campsite to Valley Lake, and then everything okay? I've been hearing a lot of noise.
Oh yeah, that's one of the dogs. He decided he wanted to bark at stuff. Oh,
okay. Yeah, he heard something, yeah. which we can cut out.
And then pitch their tent and everything. So I took that same easy hike back the next morning, and it was so anticlimactic. I was sitting there. I just walked up to the ground. They have a large viewing area. There are a number of structures built around it, a number of lodges and hotels and restaurants and things, and a number of viewing stands. I mean, I would say 300-400 people, you know, gather around that. And it's hard to tell. But anyway, so I just ran up there, and I didn't know where to go, but I just walked straight ahead. And I struck up a conversation with a family who were from L.A., visiting, and then I explained what I was doing, and then they very, you know, generously offered to film me. So I gave my film camera to the mother of the family, and then I just crawled up on top of this bench, and I just started shouting out, 750 miles! 750 miles! What does that mean? That's why I'm here. What, you know, this is what I've done, that kind of thing. And right. She filmed it all, and it was really great, and then after that, it was sort of like, now what? And then we waited for the guys to go. And then I told myself it was over, and it wasn't. The idea was I was going to hitch a ride with somebody to West Yellowstone, which is this town in Montana, because, you know, when you're in Yellowstone, you're in Wyoming. It's right over the border.
Right.
I was going to hitch a ride to West Yellowstone, and then there's at the airport, Monty had rented a car for me. I was going to get in that car. And this sounds a bit humiliating, but humbling. It took me 40 days to hike to Old Faithful, but I could drive back in 11 hours.
Right.
That's sad, yeah. Too.
Well, that's,
isn't that just, oh my.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm creative. So this is what I told myself I was doing. I was going, you know, the night before, I was like, that's all you have to do. You have to put on that pack just one more time. Tomorrow morning, walk to Old Faithful. You'll get it. You'll hitch a ride. You'll get to the airport. All that kind of stuff. Well, that just didn't happen. So at Old Faithful, everybody's like, "Wow, they cheered me and things like that," but nobody wanted to give me a ride.
I was wondering.
So totally. So I walk out. I got to put on the pack again, and I'm hiking. I'm hiking for miles again. You know, and the miles are just getting, you know, getting counted up as I'm waiting to find somebody. I'm hitching, trying to hitch, and. And eventually somebody took pity on me and gave me a ride for, you know, up to the, the major junction there. And then she had me off there. And so I just started walking again. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm not going to make it because the idea is if I hike for an hour and then it's a ride for basically an hour to get to the airport and get in the car, I can drive for 11 hours safely. But if I'm going to be hiking for 5, 6 hours, 7 hours, and then get in a car for 11 hours, that's just stupid.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm really sad about this, but I guess I'm not going to make it home tonight and see Manya after all. And I'm trying not to think about this as I'm just plodding along, putting one foot after another. And then lo and behold, a car, you know, sort of like Superman moment, stops, and they picked me up. A couple picked me up. They worked in the park, And they told me that they're encouraged to by the staff of the park to pick up hikers and give them lifts because people won't do that.
Yeah.
And I was like, thank you so much.
Yeah,
and
really.
They drove me straight to the airport, and then I was in there, and then I was driving home. It was a movie moment.
Yeah, that is just awesome.
Yeah, that's really nice that they, you know, do that with picking up the hitchhikers in the park.
Right.
Because you're right, nobody does pick up hitchhikers anymore.
That's true. It's very difficult. If you're a 20-year-old girl, I think you have an easy time to get started. 48-year-old man.
Well, I noticed that you released a new initiative today, the Peace City. Would you like to talk about that?
Certainly. What I realized was by the end of the hike, I realized that people were looking at me as a peace activist. And so when we began the hike, the march, where there was this all this suspense of around whether I could actually do this. And after 35 days of this, we began to realize, oh, I'm going to do it all right. So now what? You know, I'm going to make it. I'm not going to get attacked by a bear. I'm not going to get, you know, eaten by a mountain lion or something, or some whack job is not going to like clip me with his car or his pickup in Montana. I mean, Montana is the most, was the friendliest part of the march. I mean, there's this stretch of road from Willow Creek to Three Forks. It was like 6 miles, and four people stopped and offered to give me a lift.
Well,
and there was this woman who I knew that the offer to give me a lift was meant more than just the lift. There was something else, too, which was, after all those days on the road by myself, it was like, Jeff, you are married. Do not start thinking like this. Yeah, it was just the friendliest part. But there was also, you know, there was a couple of times where guys, and these were elderly men in pickups, they pointed their pickups at me.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, which was very scary.
Yeah.
And, right. And, you know, in Eastern Washington, that was the least friendly place. It made me embarrassed for Washington, if the people just would not help at all. So,
yeah,
we kept talking about this contrast. And yet, you know, at the end, we realized I'd made it through all of these adventures, you know, like the last 5 days. We're talking, you know, you're going to make it. What next? What's going to happen next? And I kept talking about this transformation. I feel that, you know, I never expected people to look at me as a peace activist. I certainly did not start this with that thought in mind, but it's happening now. And should I continue? Because so many people told me that they thought I should. And we started asking ourselves, what would that look like? And we weren't really quite sure. We didn't get much further than, we spent the last 15 years of our lives doing a lot of community organizing activism in Edmonds, this small town right north of Seattle, where our business is, and particularly in New York. And one of the challenges of working there is the insular attitudes of the people there. And they're really nice people, but that's just the way it is. I mean, I've been doing it for 15 years. You have to deal with that. So if I was going to do something like world peace, well, we couldn't do it in a small town like that. We would have to go through a town or city that looked outward, not inward. And let's say, but how do we live in Seattle? Although we have not been that involved in it, we treated it sort of like a reverse bedroom commute kind of thing.
Right.
And so we started asking us, maybe we should get involved in Seattle politics or something, or the Seattle scene of some sort. And Bonnie began it. She started looking up, it's the campaign season now, the city council races are on, and she looked up different candidates that she liked. And so she went out and saw them at debates and things like that, and then wound up volunteering for their campaigns. And she was telling me all about this. And so, you know, I got very interested myself. And then when I came back, you know, as I said, that final weekend before the primary, I was out there for the Shama Samant campaign and principally for the Lorena Gonzalez campaign. These two women of color, there I was, you know, campaigning hard, doorbelling a lot for them, phone banking, that kind of thing for them. And both did very well in the primaries, which is nice.
Right.
And whether that means I've earned the chance to ask them, you know, can I ask for your help on this peace thing that I'm working on? That remains to be seen. But that also worked our way, that also directed our thoughts, and I began doing research about, you know, what has been done. And I came across UNESCO's concept of the culture of peace. And UNESCO is the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, whose mandate is to encourage the development of world peace. They developed this concept of culture, they call the cultural peace, that any community can develop across the globe if they so choose. And there are 8 action areas that they define. And it's, you know, typical stuff that you would expect, like, you know, use education, foster economic development. Also, interestingly, maintain equality between women and men, which is, you know, it's a tough nut to crack. You know, foster a situation where dialogue presides rather than conflict. I'm not sure of the history, but if I understand this correctly, they had a lot of energy around this around 2000, and that's where it began. And 1% of all of humanity signed a petition saying, we like this, let's build this for humanity. And then it just sort of just runs out of steam in the early 2000s. And I think, I'm guessing now that the W administration's war on Iraq sort of like just took all the steam out of the sails.
Yeah.
All the wind out of the sails.
Yeah. It certainly sounds like it would have.
Mm-hmm. So I got very interested in this. And the second thing was this organization, it's a network, really, of cities, activists across the globe, and it's based in Dayton, Ohio. they call themselves International Cities of Peace, and they these activists have gotten their hometowns to declare themselves as such. And it could be something as simple on one end of the spectrum as the city council and the mayor issuing a resolution saying that we are a city of International City of Peace. On the other end of the spectrum, they could go further. They could develop all kinds of programs, whatever the activist wants, that fosters that sort of environment. And they, too, reference that UNESCO's concept of the culture of peace. So I've taken that in the last, I've been home for 2 weeks now, I've been thinking about this. I've taken that and first we created an org that could do this. It's first we'll work with Seattle and these political leaders in Seattle to have Seattle declare itself a city of peace. And then secondly, working with elementary schools, youth education to talk about what this looks like, a culture of peace. And because I'm an illustrator and a playwright, I'm working on a series of comics that explain those eight characteristics, or eight action areas, as they call them.
Right.
Do comics, you know, for elementary kids. And then, two, writing a short play that can do in elementary schools that explore the same concept.
Well, that certainly sounds really exciting. I'm assuming you're going to use Thrash and Jack as part of the comics.
Absolutely, using Thrash and Jack, and as part of that, I'm also working. We're putting together some sort of package that other activists can use, you know, in, throughout the Pacific Northwest. You know, say Spokane, you know, Everett, Bellingham, and Tacoma, all the principal cities, or even smaller towns too, that they can use this as royalty free. And just based on my experiences of making this happen in Seattle, working with the city council first, and then the elementary schools. And also to the arts scene and the surrounding merchants, because I know as an activist, the 15 years I've been an activist in communities, if I don't have the merchants involved, it doesn't really have any legs. You know, it doesn't go anywhere. It just sort of stops.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't.
All of those together, putting that package together and offering them a template saying, just go ahead and use this. This is a good thing. You can do this if you want. So I'm looking forward to that. That's sort of where I'm going right now. Yeah. That's sort of the, I'm also working on a new work called A World Without War, which is an illustrated work, and it's a little more intellectual, not fanatic too much. It's because the Thrash and Jack is in there too, and what it's based on is inspired by all the conversations, the hundreds of conversations I had with these people that I met on the Lightning March or the Peace March. And the question is, if they ask me, well, what about this? What about that? I mean, aren't you being just a little too idealistic? Aren't you being just, I mean, this sounds sort of a utopian kind of thing. And it sounds like a perfect world, but I don't think that, and I had to ask myself, what am I saying? What am I thinking? And so I formulated these thoughts, and then that's what I wrote down. The text is finished, and right now I'm working on the comics. So I figure another 2 months, it'll be done.
That sounds really cool. I'm going to look forward to seeing that.
Well, fantastic. Maybe we could do a follow-up interview on it or something.
Sure. When you release it, let's talk again. That'd be great.
Yeah, I think 60 days, Robert. I know my speed at you know, creating illustrations. I think something like that should work.
Well, that sounds great. So if they want to look a little further into your project, where would we send them?
PeaceCitiesUSA.org.
Okay, and we'll make sure that link is on the show notes. Plus,
great, thank you.
Yeah, we'll make sure your videos are linked and your journey, because we did follow that pretty close.
There's even a tab on that website, peacecitiesusa.org. It's called Jeff's Peace March, for anybody who is interested in what happened. There's a couple of videos, a photo or two, a radio interview I did, and something like that. And then there's a link at the bottom that if they want to follow the entire march, you know, that occurred in history, you know, on the chronology of it.
Right.
It's that's all there, too.
Well, that's going to be great. I'm going to get in there and look into that, because I'm sure I missed a couple posts from you. But
yeah, there's so many funny photos out there, like when the way my boots started going to piece at the end. I mean, all the equipment started going to you. My first pack died somewhere around Missoula. I had to get a second pack, and then my cell phone died. You know, the smartphone, but I'm out in Whitehall, Montana. There's no place to get one. So I had to buy a Go phone and had to work with that, which meant I couldn't do selfies anymore, so I had to change the way I was doing videotapes to what I was taking videos of and things like that, which made me challenge me. My boots were dying, my hat was dying, I lost the hat band, all these little things that just sort of, like, this one pair of shorts went, the socks, I was running through them left and right, the underwear was running through, the shirts did make it to the end, like to the very, very end. And it's, but it was funny. You know, the fabric just wears out with that much wear and tear.
Right.
It was amazing. And the only part of it, the only piece of equipment, if you will, that got better was my body.
Right.
My body got stronger and stronger as I kept going right up to the very end. I was amazed at it, you know, given how many blisters I had on my feet, which was a big surprise because I, you know, I trained for 200 miles. I didn't have any blisters that entire time. And then it was like I was out in, it was in the Eastern Wild when the big temps came up and I suddenly started developing these big blisters. I was like, what? Now? You're coming up now? That kind of thing.
Right.
And so that became a going concern for the next however many weeks I was doing it. But I never had problems with my hips or my ankles or my knees, or I had a lot of pain with my back. And as we see now, I mean, that's why I have what I have. I mean, it's,
right.
I must have like layer upon layer of, you know, really toughed up, or I mean, knotted up muscle tissue or something like that. But generally speaking, yeah, I was just amazed that my body kept going. It was great.
Yeah.
I had one really bad night with my mind, because my mind was always a concern. You know, out there like that, nobody to talk to. What does your mind do? And there was one night, it was the night before I got to West Yellowstone, and it was, it almost broke me. I was, it was a very, very chill wind, and it was completely overcast, so I couldn't charge my cell phone. I had a solar panel at that point recharging myself, but there was nothing to charge with. So, and I had no cell coverage either, for that matter. So there it was. It was like a period of 3 days, like the last 3 days for West Yellowstone, there was no cell coverage, so I couldn't talk to him. I couldn't talk to Monty or the logistics team or anything. And the so, you know, having no human interaction, I was relying on reading. I had this Kindle app on my phone. I was reading some favorite novels, but I couldn't because I couldn't recharge my phone. And I would think about all day as I was hiking. I was looking forward to reading at the end of the day, but on this day, I knew that I couldn't. So that was kind of sad. I had to keep tuning that out. And then this chill wind came up, and it was a chill wind for hours. I mean, 3-4 hours of this wind would stop, and I got thoroughly chilled, and I kept getting rained on. And I thought, well, you know, just keep going. Keep putting one foot after the other. And then the rain began in earnest, finally. And I was like 3 miles short to my stopping point. And then I jumped off the road for a pair of trees, but there was no shelter there. So then I saw a copse on the other side. And so I ran across the highway to that. And there was shelter, but the rain just kept pouring down. So it was too... It was no good, so I was getting thoroughly wet. I could see my sleeping bag was wet at that point, and it was just bad. So I decided, well, I'm pitching my tent right here. And part of the worry at the time was that I was running out of water. I mean, the river, it was the river was off to the left, and it kept getting smaller and smaller into the distance. And the logistics team had warned me that that may happen, but and so I would have to, I had a water filtration system, you know, so I could water up if I could find the river.
Right.
And I just didn't realize it was going to go that far off in the distance. And so I thought, well, you know, pitch the tent now and get inside, get warm, and then go figure out, you know, I could see from the distance, it looked like there was marsh ground there that I was going to have to hike through to get to the actual river. And so I figured, well, just get warm and you can go over there and figure out, you know, the water thing. Well, the rain was pouring down at this point. I was getting thoroughly soaked. And then, I had this really beautiful tent with all these big windows. But however, you have to pitch it before you can put the fly over, the rain fly over it. So as I was pitching it, it was getting filled with water from the rain. So I took my spare t-shirt, like, and I was like mopping out the inside of the tent. And, you know, after I put the fly on, and it was cold. This chill wind just never stopped. It was just so, so cold and wet. And it did get better after that. I got the mattress pad or the little pad I had, and then the space blanket, and I got those to hang out. And I crawled inside and just zipped up and sat there shivering and trying not to get depressed. And there was nothing to do. I ate some dried apricots because I was just, I should have been hungry, but I wasn't. I was just like shutting down. It was just too much. And I sat there and I stripped off my wet clothing and got into some dry stuff and crawled in a sleeping bag to try to get warm and just laid there thinking. And I told myself, when the rain stops, you'll get up and go figure out the water thing. But it didn't stop, not for 10 hours.
Wow.
And this was a tiny tent, so I'm like in a space capsule. And so there I am in this little pod. And I just sat there getting more and more depressed. And I thought about, maybe I can't do this anymore. Maybe it's time to just get up, break camp, and just get out there. And just, I'm sure somebody will pick me up in this kind of weather. And just get into West Yellowstone and call Manya and tell her, I'm sorry, I couldn't do it. The weather just beat me. And I thought instead about, you've come so far. Don't give in now. Just stay in this tent. And there was this really bad moment. I must have fallen asleep and I woke up at 10 or something, or 12. It was midnight, that's right. And the rain had stopped, but the chill wind was still going. And I reached down to my fleece jacket and I realized it was utterly soaked with water. And I thought, God, I got to put that on. Everything was wet inside. Everything was wet and cold. And I just didn't know. I couldn't go on anymore. And then I made up this image of a rock that gets polished by the elements. And we think that rock is so beautiful because it's so smooth, and we pass it to each other, and we say we admire it, or we think it's just a wonderful thing. But being polished by the elements is not a very good experience for that rock, that pebble. And I realized maybe that's what was happening to me. I was being polished by the elements. And I kept thinking about that and told myself to stay in that tent, find a way. And I did. And drank as little water as I could and made it through the night. I was shivering most of the night. I barely slept. I just would fall asleep and wake up again and fall asleep and wake up again because I was so cold. But there was nothing to see. And then finally, and of course, I look outside because it had stopped raining. I could look outside now, but it was an overcast sky, so no stars, which meant it could start raining again at any point as far as I was concerned. But finally, when I did get enough lights to work with, I got up and put on my cold and clammy clothes, which was, in truth, it wasn't as bad as I had feared, or maybe that was just my mindset at the time. I was not going to quit. And so I got up and put them on, and I thought, well, I'm going to get that water. So I went looking for the river, and I could not find it. I was out there for I don't know how long, and I realized to my vexation that my boots, right, my waterproofing had worn off. And so I'm walking through all this wet, and so I've got the sloshing puddles in my boots that I can hear as I'm walking, and yet I can't find water that I can filter and put into my little water pouch. So I tell myself, well, I guess I have to just take a one small sip after every mile. Let's just go into this one now. And went back and struck camp and geared up. And about 2 miles down the road, I found the river again. And that sort of changed things. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I kept thinking about this really prosaic image of the previous night. I was thinking about the pebble being polished by the elements. The next morning, I was thinking about a chicken fried steak with hash browns and lots of gravy. I was going to march in the West Yellowstone, and I was going to stop at the first cafe I could find, and that's what I was going to order.
That sounds good anyway. Well, it's been a wonderful conversation with you tonight. I mean, it's been great.
Thank you very much, Robert. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. It was really nice hearing it.
Yeah. We'll definitely get back together.
And I'll let you know how the book turns out.
What was that?
And I will let you know how A World Without War turns out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll definitely get back together when that starts coming out.
Yeah, check back okay. in.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Have a great evening.
All right, you too.
You too.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Turn my mic off.